Good evening, this is Mark Litch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and biographer Nicholas Fox Weber. He is the director of the Joseph and Ani Albers Foundation, and we're continuing our conversation about his new book. It's a monumental, fascinating volume. Ani and Joseph Albers, Equal and Unequal. Nick, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
And Mark, a great pleasure to hear your voice again.
Now, this book, and it's a huge volume and a beautiful book with all the reproductions, but I have to say, the written parts are just as interesting. And it must have been a very tough book to put together. But here's the question I have asked for you. Are there other artists' biographies or books like this that you have admired? I'm not saying that they inspired this book, that you considered to be the treat the artist in a special way, that you feel like you got to know the artist. Are the ones that you've read before?
You know, Mark, it wouldn't have occurred to me to come up in advance to come up with the answer I'm going to give you. But what flashed before my mind was a wonderful book called Remembering Mr. Maugham, which is a biography of Somerset Maugham by Garson Kamen, with an introduction by Noel Coward.
Wow. So it's an all-star cast.
I remember it very clearly. I was on assignment from Architectural Digest in Marrakesh. It was in the guest room, and I don't know if I should admit this in public, but it's the only book I've ever taken from a guest room. I realized my hostess couldn't even remember anyone's name, so that's how I justified it to myself. But it was so intimate and personal and in the right tone.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that got to me. Garson Kanin just had that worldly Somerset Maugham aura that made him the perfect person to tell Maugham's story. And Noel Coward had Maugham's sort of humor and wry touch. And so that book for me was an example of a non-standard biography that doesn't answer your question about other artists.
No, but it does, because I love the term non-standard, because this is a non-standard biography too. And you knew these artists too, and that makes a huge amount of difference, because it becomes really obvious as you read through the book that your, I guess I would say, intimate knowledge of the two artists, Ani and Joseph, really makes a difference, because you're able to have these sort of interesting takeout chapters too within the narrative that are fascinating. But let's talk about them. Last time we talked about them, they were in Germany on their way to America, and they end up at Black Mountain College in North Carolina. Talk to me about how that occurred. What happened to bring them to Black Mountain College?
The Bauhaus closed in April of 1933, and by June, Joseph didn't have a job, nor did Annie. They were living on the little bit of money she had from her parents, and actually in a nice apartment that her parents rented for them, but they didn't know what lay ahead. Annie saw the handwriting on the wall being Jewish, and Joseph, as a modernist, knew that his future wasn't assured in Germany by any means. Annie ran into the American architect Philip Johnson, much discussed these days. She ran into him on a street in Berlin and invited him for tea. And in the course of tea, he looked at some material by her and said that he thought they were by Lily Reich, Mies van der Rohe's great friend. And Annie said, no, they were hers. And Philip was appalled at what he thought was a slight injustice to Annie. And in the course of that discussion, and Philip told me about it in an interview years ago, he said, what would you think of coming to America? And Annie just said, you know, sounded great. She was always up for any new adventure in the world. And a few weeks later, they received a telegram inviting Joseph to become the professor at Black Mountain College in North Carolina. This new school had been created the year before in 1932, and it was created in part by a man called Ted Dreyer. And if you can follow this, Mark, Ted Dreyer's mother, Ethel, was a member of the Cosmopolitan Club in New York. There she was talking with her friend Margaret Lewison, wife of a trustee. Margaret was so fascinated with the sound of Black Mountain College that she said, "Oh, I must tell Eddie about it." Eddie was Edward M.M. Warburg, who was a cousin of Margaret Lewison's, and she told him, and he was a young man working without salary as a curator at the Museum of Modern Art, as was Philip Johnson. And Eddie told Philip Johnson about Black Mountain College and its search for an art professor. And Johnson instantly replied, "We must have Joseph Albers."
Wow.
So Annie and Joseph received a telegram inviting them to Black Mountain, North Carolina. And Annie said, she told this to me, she said, "We had no idea where North Carolina was. We thought it might be in the Philippines." And she subsequently went to the embassy, found out that it had a lovely climate, and they cabled back with the warning that Joseph spoke no English. And a telegram came by return wire saying, "Come anyway." And very quietly, Edward Warburg and Abby Aldrich Rockefeller and some other people at the Museum of Modern Art bought the Alberses their first-class steamship tickets and made sure that the visas came through easily. And Annie and Joseph were off for a totally new world.
I want you to just take one moment, in a very short moment, because we have so much to talk about. So to talk about Black Mountain College, because I bet most people here in America have never heard of it.
Black Mountain College was an experimental educational institution established in the woods of North Carolina with the desire to make art the focal point of the curriculum. And in the course of its nearly 30 years, it was home to, among others, Robert Rauschenberg, John Cage, Merce Cunningham, the Alberses, some great poets, and other major names of American modernism.
What's amazing to me reading this book, first of all, with this section of the book, things become much more intimate in the way that you read about the Alberses. Because it was here and it's much more recent, even there's candid photographs of them. And their life in America becomes fascinating. Joseph becomes a renowned teacher of art. You mentioned Rauschenberg. His relationship to Rauschenberg was fascinating. Talk about that.
Well, his relationship with Rauschenberg has often been depicted as a negative one.
Yeah.
And I felt that it was my opportunity to set the record straight, which is that the two of them, although they teased each other greatly and had very different approaches to making art, the two of them had enormous respect for one another. And I was lucky enough to interview Bob Rauschenberg toward the end of his life, and he spoke to me about the degree to which he really deified Joseph, which was part of the problem for him, that Joseph was almost too powerful a figure for him.
Huh. Jacob Lawrence, another artist.
Jacob Lawrence, and I wanted to mention, actually, first, Robert De Niro, father of the well-known actor, who was another student of Joseph's.
Wow.
And there, too, the record has not been correct. If you read the only book that discusses their relationship, you would think that De Niro left because of Joseph and out of a negative reaction to him. And on the contrary, if you delve into the letters written when Black Mountain was functioning, you would discover that Joseph defended Robert De Niro, encouraged him to stay, took a personal interest in him, and made sure that he had the funding to be there. In the case of Jacob Lawrence, you have the first Black art teacher to have an important position in the American South.
And that was thanks to Joseph, correct?
That was thanks to Joseph. Joseph admired Jacob Lawrence's work. He and Annie prevailed at a faculty meeting of people at Black Mountain to get through the idea that they needed to have Black students and Black faculty. There were many people at Black Mountain who thought that this should not occur,
who were afraid of violence
on the campus, who were bigoted themselves. But Annie and Joseph prevailed. Annie spoke beautifully at one of those faculty meetings and said that, in essence, that all that mattered in any human being was his or her heart and intelligence. And Joseph made the arrangements for the Lawrences to travel down from Boston in such a way that by going in the Pullman car, they did not in Washington have to switch to a segregated car only for Black people, because Pullman was integrated to a point far below the Mason-Dixon line, and only then did the Lawrences have to go into a segregated car for the rest of the trip.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to talk to him. Writer-biographer Nicholas Fox Weber. He's the director of the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation, and we're continuing our conversation about his monumental new book, Annie and Joseph Albers, Equal and Unequal. I want to talk about Annie for a bit, because there's a phrase that she used, tactile sensibility.
Yes.
And I want to talk about this, because I finally only understood it from reading your book. This is about the pleasure of touch and the texture of materials. And it was a very important quality for her. Talk to me about that.
Well, when you first mentioned tactile sensibility, I was thinking about Annie's description of the first trip that she and Joseph took to Mexico from Black Mountain in 1936. And Annie was waiting in the car while Joseph and their friends, Ted and Bobby Dreyer, went in to see a church interior. Annie had great difficulty walking and elected to stay behind. And a Mexican boy came up to her with a blanket and something wrapped up inside it. And it was a baby goat. And he tried to sell it to Annie. And Annie loved the feeling of the goat's skin, but she said, "No, I'm afraid I couldn't make use of this." And then he showed her a wonderful pre-Columbian object, and she described the cool smoothness of this wonderful clay figurine, and she said she would be interested in that, and she also asked him if he might consider selling her the blanket in which he had wrapped the goat, and Annie was very aware of the texture of that textile.
And that's throughout her work, is that that seems to be one of the main themes that goes on through her work at this time, about the surface appearance of materials. There are so many wonderful examples in this book, many that I'd never seen before. There's a study made with pinpricks that you reproduce in the book. And looking at works like that, that you really start to understand her idea of tactile sensibility. And how she uses it in her work. It's fascinating.
Annie had such an open mind, and because she didn't busy herself too much doing nonsense, because she was in many ways more like someone on a form of lockdown having to do with the way that she and Joseph elected to live, she really noticed things. So, for example, she bought a cap on her honeymoon in Florence because it was quite cold out, and she wondered where its elastic quality came from. And so she took it apart, and she discovered a cellophane-like substance in the cap. Annie loved cellophane. She began to weave with cellophane, metallic thread, jute, cotton, silk, all sorts of materials. And going back to your idea of tactile sensibility, she was so aware of the difference between the properties of velvet and the properties of metallic thread and the way that it reflects light and feels smooth. And throughout her life as a textile maker, she loved juxtaposing surprising combinations of materials.
It was amazing to look through your book and look at the two of them and their later work that was a reaction to this trip to Mexico. Joseph did these fascinating abstract line pieces that are just beautiful. And then she did textile stuff. The weirdest thing about this is they collected Mesoamerican art, but they only had one piece on view when you went to visit them. They had huge amounts of it, but you never saw it.
Mark, it was the strangest thing. There was an Aztec, a stone corn goddess, an Aztec figurine, in front of their fireplace. But otherwise, you didn't see any Mesoamerican art in the house. And a few months after Joseph died, Annie took me downstairs, and I was facing the clothes washer and the dryer. And on my right, there were two closet doors, cheap, very standard fare Hollywood doors. And I knew that in a typical American house, behind such doors, there would be the closet where you keep cleaning supplies. It's exactly what it was built for. And Annie took out her big keychain and opened those doors. The smell that came out of there was of the earth itself. There were over 1,000 figurines and other objects packed in there. Now, you may not believe me about the quantity, but Joseph had many very, very small Chapiquero figurines.
Oh my God.
And so these were stacked inside plastic boxes, and we inventoried all of the work eventually, but it was all packed in there, everything from objects that they had bought for a few pesos when they had little money in the early years to objects for which they had swapped expensive works of art and bought from fashionable dealers in the later years of their lives.
Wow. Now, talking about Joseph's works, at this time, you talk about, there's a great essay on windows and how windows were inspiring to a number of his works. And as you watch Joseph's work during this time period that's reproduced in this book, you can start to see these pieces leading up to the homages to the square. You really can see these sort of these window-like images throughout his work that are just incredible. But you can see an evolution to his work.
Mark, I love the way you're bringing that all together, because indeed he made windows literally out of glass when he was at the Bauhaus. He painted windows as a subject when he was at the Bauhaus, a wonderful black and white work where the geometry of windows fascinated him. And then he created window-like paintings at Black Mountain leading up to the homages.
Yeah.
And the homages indeed have that fascination of drawing you into the distance, but also keeping you up close.
Yeah, I really understood that those pieces better by looking at the precedents for them, and it makes total sense. But there's an interesting sidebar to his work at this time. He fell in love with American leaves, and there's a series of things I'd never seen before in your book of artwork that Joseph made out of leaves.
Well, I was lucky enough after Joseph died to have the opportunity to go through a storage room, and I found about 7 collages made by him of autumn leaves. For their conservation, we worked not only with a paper conservator, but with someone from the Museum of Natural History in New York.
Wow.
Because we wanted the leaves themselves not to disintegrate. And we preserve these works in very good condition. And indeed, Joseph thought that if you change the position of leaves, you could make them appear as if they're floating.
Yep.
You could use colored paper behind them so that they're in front of the earth and the sky. You could make them dance. Annie was intrigued with the autumn leaves, and it says something about their marriage that when Joseph had a lot of student work in his studio, she took a collage that she had made and put it in the middle of the pile without saying a thing to him. When Joseph went through the student work, he took out one piece and said that it was exceptionally good, and it was Annie's. And knowing her and knowing him, I don't know that she ever told him.
Okay. The other great thing about your book are these little details about how they are as people, and which really enriches this whole volume because you get to know them and you so wish you could have known them while they were alive. I want to talk about clothing. They were deliberately austere. Both of them. Yes. Never extravagant. Suits for Joseph were sort of solid gray. He actually went on a search for just a plain gray necktie. He just wanted a necktie that was absolutely plain gray. And they hated mustaches and beards. But I love this sort of offhand sort of cutting remarks that Annie would make when somebody came in who was wearing something too flamboyant and too odd. Because she could be quite, she could dish it.
They could both dish it. Appearance was very important to them, and they did.
But it's
not
very understated. I mean, it's perfectly in line with their ideas about their work. It's perfectly understated.
Understated and correct, and
right.
Tactile sensibility was important.
Exactly.
I remember when Annie discovered Ultra Suede. She loved this material because it was synthetic, but felt like suede. And one of the first times that I was with them, I felt that it was such a relief to be away from my hometown of West Hartford, where I thought people were too focused on clothing and the country club and all those things. And I remember hearing Annie say to me one day, and then we got Joseph a seersucker at Abercrombie's. And there was something about her way of saying seersucker, and this is the old Abercrombie and Fitch, which used to be a one-stop department store in New York next to Brooks Brothers. And the material of seersucker was just perfect in the Albers' eyes. Beautiful to look at, nice, yep, and lightweight. The incident that you refer to with the gray necktie, I think it's worth telling because Joseph was considered the foremost colorist and teacher,
yeah,
of color of the 20th century. His great book, Interaction of Color, has been translated into over 20 languages, most recently Mongolian. And Joseph was given the first solo retrospective of a living artist at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1971. And he went into the New Haven Yale community clothier called Jay Press, and he wanted to get a necktie for the opening. And he said to the salesman that he wanted a necktie. He wanted a solid gray necktie, to which the salesman replied, "Oh, sir, you have no color sense."
Whoa!
He turned deep red. Annie had to put out the fire.
We only have a few minutes left. There's so much in this section of the book that you can talk about. First of all, their interactions with other notable people of the time. Richard Buckminster Fuller. What I learned that I never knew about Buckminster Fuller is he always had to have meat.
Yes. Annie and Joseph's lawyer, the wonderful Lee Eastman, once had a conversation about Bucky, as they called him, and I remember that both of them remembered inviting him for dinner and having him arrive with a with an uncooked steak. And he would always explain to his host or hostess that he wanted the steak cooked for him, that it was the only thing he ate. He ate nothing green. And, quote, the cows ate everything green for him.
Wow. The incredible thing is how tolerant they were, although they may be critical of sort of bohemian clothes and stuff like that. They're very tolerant of people who are idiosyncratic, like Buckminster Fuller.
Completely. Well, they admired inventiveness.
That's right. So if you're inventive, you're in their good books.
If you were inventive. But on the other hand, as an example, you said they could dish it out.
Oh, my God.
I'm very aware of a time that a fancy New York interior designer showed up in Orange, Connecticut, where the Albertsons were living.
I know it's coming.
Annie opened the door for him. I was upstairs with Joseph at the kitchen table. And I said that the guest had arrived, and Joseph acted as if I hadn't said anything. And then Joseph looked downstairs and said the man's name, followed by, the man, I should explain, was wearing a floppy hat and pink sunglasses. And Joseph looked at him and simply said, "You look like a rabbit."
With that, we're going to have to sign off because we're out of time. We have so much more to talk about in just that. And we'll talk later about the last section of the book. My returning guest tonight is writer-biographer Nicholas Fox Weber. He's the director of the Joseph and Annie Albers Foundation. And we've been continuing our conversation about his monumental new book. It's a wonderful artist's biography. Annie and Joseph Albers, Equal and Unequal. Nick, it's been a pleasure.
And Mark, I cannot thank you enough.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.